Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Chapter 10 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 10. I go back to that house in Hartford, where I was so often a happy guest, with tenderness for each of its endearing aspects. Over the chimney in the library, which had been cured of smoking by so much art and science, Clemens had written in perennial brass the words of Emerson, "The ornament of a house is the friends who frequent it," and he gave his guests a welcome of the simplest and sweetest cordiality. But I must not go aside to them from my recollections of him, which will be of sufficient garrulity, if I give them as fully as I wish. The windows of the library looked northward from the hillside above which the house stood, and over the little valley with the stream in it, and they showed the leaves of the trees that almost brushed them as in a Claude Lorraine glass. To the eastward, the dining room opened amply, and to the south there was a wide hall, where the voices of friends made themselves heard as they entered without ceremony, and answered his joyous hail. At the west was a little semicircular conservatory, of a pattern invented by Mrs. Harriet Beecher Stowe, and adopted in most of the houses of her kindly neighborhood. The plants were set in the ground, and the flowering vines climbed up the sides and overhung the roof above the silent spray of a fountain, accompanied by calyas and other water-loving lilies. There, while we breakfasted, Patrick came in from the barn and sprinkled the pretty bower, which poured out its responsive perfume in the delicate accents of its varied blossoms. Breakfast was Clemens' best meal, and he sat longer at his steak and coffee than at the courses of his dinner. Luncheon was nothing to him, unless, as might happen, he made it his dinner, and reserved the later repast as the occasion of walking up and down the room, and discoursing at large on anything that came into his head. Like most good talkers, he liked other people to have their say. He did not talk them down. He stopped instantly at another's remark, and gladly or politely heard him through. He even made believe to find suggestion or inspiration in what was said. his children came to the table, as I have told, and after dinner he was apt to join his fine tenor to their trebles in singing. Fully half of our meetings were at my house in Cambridge, where he made himself as much at home as in Hartford. He would come, ostensibly, to stay at the Parker House in Boston, and take a room, where he would light the gas and leave it burning. After dressing, while he drove out to Cambridge and stayed 2 or 3 days with us. Once, I suppose it was after a lecture, he came in evening dress and passed 24 hours with us in that guise, wearing an overcoat to hide it when we went out for a walk. Sometimes he wore the slippers which he preferred to shoes at home, and, if it was muddy, as it was wont to be in Cambridge, he would put a pair of rubbers over them for our rambles. He liked the lawlessness and our delight in allowing it, and he rejoiced in the confession of his hostess, after we had once almost worn ourselves out in our pleasure with the intense talk, with the stories and the laughing, that his coming almost killed her. But it was worth it. In those days he was troubled with sleeplessness, or rather with reluctant sleepiness, and he had various specifics for promoting it. At first it had been champagne, just before going to bed, and we provided that. But later he appeared from Boston with 4 bottles of lager beer under his arms. Lager beer, he said now, was the only thing to make you go to sleep, and we provided that. Still later, on a visit I paid him at Hartford, I learned that hot Scotch was the only soporific worth considering, and Scotch whiskey duly found its place on our sideboard. One day, very long afterward, I asked him if he were still taking hot Scotch to make him sleep. He said he was not taking anything. For a while, he had found going to bed on the bathroom floor a soporific. Then one night he went to rest in his own bed at 10 o'clock, and had gone promptly to sleep without anything. He had done the like, with the like effect, ever since. Of course, it amused him. There were few experiences of life, grave or gay, which did not amuse him, even when they wronged him. He came on to Cambridge in April 1875 to go with me to the centennial ceremonies at Concord, in celebration of the Battle of the Minutemen with the British troops 100 years before. We both had special invitations, including passage from Boston, but I said, why bother to go into Boston when we could just as well take the train for Concord at the Cambridge station? He equally decided that it would be absurd, so we breakfasted deliberately, and then walked to the station, reasoning of many things as usual. When the train stopped, we found it packed inside and out. People stood dense on the platforms of the cars. To our startled eyes, they seemed to project from the windows, and unless memory betrays me, they lay strewn upon the roofs, like brakemen slain at the post of duty. Whether this was really so or not, it is certain that the train presented an impenetrable front even to our imagination, and we left it to go its way without the slightest effort to board. We remounted the fame-worn steps of Porter's Station, and began exploring North Cambridge for some means of transportation overland to Concord, for we were that far on the road by which the British went and came on the day of battle. The liverymen whom we appealed to received us, some with compassion, some with derision, but in either mood convinced us that we could not have hired a cat to attempt our conveyance, much less a horse or vehicle of any description. It was a raw, windy day, very unlike the exceptionally hot April day when the routed redcoats, pursued by the colonials, fled panting back to Boston, with their tongues hanging out like dogs. But we could not take due comfort in the vision of their discomfiture. We could almost envy them, for they had at least got to Concord. A swift procession of coaches, carriages, and buggies, all going to Concord, passed us, inert and helpless, on the sidewalk in the peculiarly cold mud of North Cambridge. We began to wonder if we might not stop one of them and bribe it to take us, but we had not the courage to try, and Clemens seized the opportunity to begin suffering with an acute indigestion, which gave his humor a very dismal cast. I felt keenly the shame of defeat, and the guilt of responsibility for our failure. And when a gay party of students came toward us on the top of a tally-ho, luxuriously empty inside, we felt that our chance had come, and our last chance. He said that if I would stop them and tell them who I was, they would gladly, perhaps proudly, give us passage. I contended that if with his far vaster renown we would approach them, our success would be assured. While we stood, lost in this contest of civilities, the coach passed us, with gay notes blown from the horns of the students, and then Clemens started in pursuit, encouraged with shouts from the merry party who could not imagine who was trying to run them down, to a rivalry in speed. The unequal match could end only in one way, and I am glad I cannot recall what he said when he came back to me. Since then, I have often wondered at the grief which would have wrung those blithe young hearts if they could only have known that they might have had the company of Mark Twain to Concord that day and did not. We hung about unavailingly in the bitter wind a little longer, and then slowly, very slowly, made our way home. We wished to pass as much time as possible in order to give probability to the deceit we intended to practice, for we could not bear to own ourselves baffled in our boasted wisdom of taking the train at Porter's Station, and had agreed to say that we had been to Concord and got back. Even after coming home to my house, we felt that our statement would be wanting in verisimilitude without further delay, and we crept quietly into my library and made up a roaring fire on the hearth and thawed ourselves out in the heat of it before we regained our courage for the undertaking. With all these precautions, we failed, for when our statement was imparted to the proposed victim, she instantly pronounced it unreliable, and we were left with it on our hands intact. I think the humor of this situation was finally a greater pleasure to Clemens than an actual visit to Concord would have been. Only a few weeks before his death, he laughed our defeat over with one of my family in Bermuda, and exulted in our prompt detection. End of chapter 10. Read by Dennis Sayers of Modesto, California for LibriVox. Fall 2006. Chapter 11 from My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 11. From our joint experience in failing, I argue that Clemens' affection for me must have been great to enable him to condone in me the final defection which was apt to be the end of our enterprises. I have fancied that I presented to him a surface of such entire trustworthiness that he could not imagine the depths of unreliability beneath it, and that, never realizing it, he always broke through with fresh surprise but unimpaired faith. He liked, beyond all things, to push an affair to the bitter end, and the end was never too bitter unless it brought grief or harm to another. Once, at a telegraph office, at a railway station, he was treated with such insolent neglect by the young lady in charge, who was preoccupied in a flirtation with a gentleman friend, that, emulous of the public spirit which he admired in the English, he told her he should report her to her superiors, and, probably to her astonishment, he did so. He went back to Hartford, and in due time the poor girl came to me in terror and in tears, for I had abetted Clemens in his action and had joined my name to his in his appeal to the authorities. She was threatened with dismissal unless she made full apology to him and brought back assurance of its acceptance. I felt able to give this, and, of course, he eagerly approved. I think he telegraphed his approval. Another time, some years afterward, we sat down together in places near the end of a car, and a brakeman came in looking for his official notebook. Clemens found that he had sat down upon it, and handed it to him. The man scolded him very abusively, and came back again and again, still scolding him for having no more sense than to sit down on a notebook. The patience of Clemens in bearing it was so angelic that I saw fit to comment, "I suppose you will report this fellow?" "Yes," he answered, slowly and sadly. "That's what I should have done once. But now I remember that he gets $20 a month." Nothing could have been wiser, nothing tenderer, and his humanity was not for humanity alone. He abhorred the dull and savage joy of the sportsman in a lucky shot, an unerring aim, and once when I met him in the country, he had just been sickened by the success of a gunner in bringing down a blackbird, and he described the poor, stricken, glossy thing, how it lay throbbing its life out on the grass, with such pity as he might have given a wounded child. I find this a fit place to say that his mind and soul were with those who do the hard work of the world, in fear of those who give them a chance for their livelihoods and underpay them all they can. He never went so far in socialism as I have gone, if he went that way at all, but he was fascinated with looking backward, and had Bellamy to visit him, and from the first he had a luminous vision of organized labor as the only present help for working men. He would show that side with such clearness and such force that you could not say anything in hopeful contradiction. He saw with that relentless insight of his that with unions was the working man's only present hope of standing up like a man against money and the power of it. There was a time when I was afraid that his eyes were a little holden with the truth, but in the very last talk I heard from him, I found that I was wrong, and that this great humorist was as great a humanist as ever. I wish that all the work folk could know this, and could know him their friend in life as he was in literature, as he was in such a glorious gospel of equality as the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. End of chapter 11. Recording by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Winter 2006. Chapter 12 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 12. Whether I will or no, I must let things come into my story thought-wise, as he would have let them, for I cannot remember them in their order. He suddenly stormed in with a friend of his and mine, Mr. Twitchell, and immediately began to eat and drink of our supper, for they had come straight to our house from walking to Boston, or so great a part of the way as to be a-hungered and athirst. I can see him now as he stood up in the midst of our friends, with his head thrown back, and in his hand a dish of those escalloped oysters, without which no party in Cambridge was really a party, exulting in the tale of his adventure, which had abounded in the most original characters and amusing incidents at every mile of their progress. They had broken their journey with a night's rest, and they had helped themselves lavishly out by rail in the last half. But still it had been a mighty walk to do in 2 days. Clemens was a great walker in those years, and was always telling of his tramps with Mr. Twitchell to Talcott's Tower, 10 miles out of Hartford. As he walked, of course, he talked, and of course he smoked. Whenever he had been a few days with us, the whole house had to be aired, for he smoked all over it, from breakfast to bedtime. He always went to bed with a cigar in his mouth, and sometimes, mindful of my fire insurance, I went up and took it away, still burning, after he had fallen asleep. I do not know how much a man may smoke and live, but apparently he smoked as much as a man could, for he smoked incessantly. He did not care much to meet people, as I fancied, and we were greedy of him for ourselves. He was precious to us, and I would not have exposed him to the critical edge of that Cambridge acquaintance which might not have appreciated him at, say, his transatlantic value. In America his popularity was as instant as it was vast, but it must be acknowledged that for a much longer time here than in England, polite learning hesitated his praise. In England, rank, fashion, and culture rejoiced in him. Lord mayors, lord chief justices, and magnates of many kinds were his hosts. He was desired in country houses, and his bold genius captivated the favor of periodicals which spurned the rest of our nation. But in his own country, it was different. In proportion as people thought themselves refined, they questioned that quality which all recognize in him now, but which was then the inspired knowledge of the simple-hearted multitude. I went with him to see Longfellow, but I do not think Longfellow made much of him, and Lowell made less. He stopped, as if with the long Semitic curve of Clemens' nose, which in the indulgence of his passion for finding every one more or less a Jew, he pronounced unmistakably racial. It was two of my most fastidious Cambridge friends who accepted him with the English, the European entirety, namely George Eliot Norton and Professor Francis J. Child. Norton was then newly back from a long sojourn abroad, and his judgments were localized. He met Clemens as if they had both been in England, and rejoiced in his bold freedom from environment, and in the rich variety and boundless reach of his talk. Child was of a personal liberty as great in its fastidious way as that of Clemens himself, and though he knew him only at second hand, he exulted in the most audacious instance of his grotesquerie, as I shall have to tell by and by, almost solely. I cannot say just why Clemens seemed not to hit the favor of our community of scribes and scholars, as Bret Harte had done, when he came on from California and swept them before him, disrupting their dinners and delaying their lunches with impunity. But it is certain he did not, and I had better say so. I am surprised to find from the bibliographical authorities that it was so late as 1875 when he came with the manuscript of Tom Sawyer and asked me to read it as a friend and critic and not as an editor. I have an impression that this was at Mrs. Clemens' instance in his own uncertainty about printing it. She trusted me, I can say with a satisfaction few things now give me, to be her husband's true and cordial adviser, and I was so. I believe I never failed him in this part, though in so many of our enterprises and projects I was as false as water, through my temperamental love of backing out of any undertaking. I believe this never ceased to astonish him, and it has always astonished me. It appears to me quite out of character. Though it is certain that an undertaking, when I have entered upon it, holds me rather than I it. But however this immaterial matter may be, I am glad to remember that I thoroughly liked Tom Sawyer, and said so with every possible amplification. Very likely, I also made my suggestions for its improvement. I could not have been a real critic without that, and I have no doubt they were gratefully accepted, and, I hope, never acted upon. I went with him to the horse car station in Harvard Square, as my frequent wont was, and put him aboard a car with his manuscript in his hand, stayed and reassured, so far as I counted, concerning it. I do not know what his misgivings were. Perhaps they were his wife's misgivings, for she wished him to be known not only for the wild and boundless humor that was in him, but for the beauty and tenderness and natural piety. And she would not have had him judged by a too close fidelity to the rude conditions of Tom Sawyer's life. This is the meaning that I read into the fact of his coming to me with his doubts. End of chapter 12. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Winter, 2006. Chapter 13 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 13. Clemens had then, and for many years, the habit of writing to me about what he was doing, and still more of what he was experiencing. Nothing struck his imagination, in or out of the daily routine, but he wished to write me of it, and he wrote with the greatest fullness and a lavish dramatization, sometimes to the length of 20 or 40 pages, so that I have now perhaps 1,500 pages of his letters. They will, no doubt, some day be published, but I am not even referring to them in these records, which I think had best come to the reader with an old man's falterings and uncertainties. With his frequent absences, and my own abroad, and the intrusion of calamitous cares, the rich tide of his letters was more and more interrupted. At times it almost ceased, and then it would come again, a torrent. In the very last weeks of his life, he burst forth, and, though too weak himself to write, he dictated his rage with me for recommending to him a certain author whose truthfulness he could not deny, but whom he hated for his truthfulness to sordid and ugly conditions. At heart, Clemens was romantic, and he would have had the world of fiction stately and handsome and whatever the real world was not. But he was not romanticistic, and he was too helplessly an artist not to wish his own work to show life as he had seen it. I was preparing to rap him back for those letters when I read that he had got home to die. He would have liked the rapping back. He liked coming to Boston, especially for those luncheons and dinners in which the fertile hospitality of our publisher, Osgood, abounded. He dwelt equidistant from Boston and New York, and he had special friends in New York, but he said he much preferred coming to Boston. Of late years he never went there, and he had lost the habit of it long before he had come home from Europe to live in New York. At these feasts, which were often of after-dinner speaking measure, he could always be trusted for something of amazing delightfulness. Once, when Osgood could think of no other occasion for a dinner, he gave himself a birthday dinner, and asked his friends and authors. The beautiful and splendid trooper-like Blaring was there, and I recall how, in the long, rambling speech in which Clemens went round the table, hitting every head at it, and especially visiting Osgood with thanks for his ingenious pretext for our entertainment, he congratulated, Blaring upon his engineering genius and his hypnotic control of municipal governments. He said that if there was a plan for draining a city at a cost of $1,000,000, by seeking the level of the water in the downhill course of the sewers, Blaring would come with a plan to drain that town uphill at twice the cost, and carry it through the Common Council without opposition. It is hard to say whether the time was gladder at those dinners or at the small lunches at which Osgood and Aldrich and I foregathered with him and talked the afternoon away till well toward the winter twilight. He was a great figure, and the principal figure, at one of the first of the now worn-out authors' readings, which was held in the Boston Museum to aid a Longfellow memorial. It was the late George Parsons Lathrop, everybody seems to be late in these sad days, who imagined the reading, but when it came to a price for seats, I can always claim the glory of fixing it at $5. The price, if not the occasion, proved irresistible, and the museum was packed from the floor to the topmost gallery. Norton presided, and when it came Clemens' turn to read, he introduced him with such exquisite praises as he best knew how to give. But before he closed, he fell a prey to one of those lapses of tact which are the peculiar peril of people of the greatest tact. He was reminded of Darwin's delight in Mark Twain, and how, when he came from his long day's exhausting study and sank into bed at midnight, he took up a volume of Mark Twain, whose books he had always kept on a table beside him, and whatever had been his tormenting problem or excess of toil, he felt secure of a good night's rest from it. A sort of blank ensued, which Clemens filled in the only possible way. He said that he should always be glad that he had contributed to the repose of that great man whom science owed so much, and then, without waiting for the joy in every breast to burst forth, he began to read. It was curious to watch his triumph with the house. His carefully studied effects would reach the first rows in the orchestra first, and ripple in laughter back to the standees against the wall, and then, with a fine resurgence, come again to the rear orchestra seats, and so rise from gallery to gallery till it fell back, a cataract of applause from the topmost rows of seats. He was such a practiced speaker that he knew all the stops of that simple instrument, man, and there is no doubt that these results were accurately intended from his unerring knowledge. He was the most consummate public performer I ever saw, and it was an incomparable pleasure to hear him lecture. On the platform, he was the great and finished actor which he probably would have been on the stage. He was fond of private theatricals, and liked to play in them with his children and their friends, in dramatizations of such stories of his as The Prince and the Pauper. But I never saw him in any of these scenes. When he read his manuscript to you, it was with a thorough, however involuntary, recognition of its dramatic qualities. He held that an actor added fully half to the character the author created. With my own hurried and half-hearted reading of passages which I wished to try on him from unprinted chapters, say, out of The Undiscovered Country or A Modern Instance, he said frankly that my reading could spoil anything. He was realistic, but he was essentially histrionic, and he was rightly so. What we have strongly conceived, we ought to make others strongly imagine, and we ought to use every genuine art to that end. End of chapter 13, read by Dennis Sayers, for LibriVox in Modesto, California, winter 2006. Chapter 14 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to find out how to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 14. There came a time when the lecturing which had been the joy of his prime became his loathing, loathing unutterable, and when he renounced it with indescribable violence. Yet he was always hankering for those flesh-pots whose savor lingered on his palate and filled his nostrils after his withdrawal from the platform. The author's readings, when they had won their brief popularity, abounded in suggestion for him. Reading from one's book was not so bad as giving a lecture, written for a lecture's purpose, and he was willing at last to compromise. He had a magnificent scheme for touring the country with Aldrich and Mr. G. W. Cable and myself in a private car, with a cook of our own, and every facility for living on the fat of the land. We should read only 4 times a week, in an entertainment that should last not more than an hour and a half. He would be the impresario, and would guarantee us others at least $75 a day, and pay every expense of the enterprise, which he provisionally called the circus himself. But Aldrich and I were no longer in those early 30s when we so cheerfully imagined memorable murders for subscription publication. We both abhorred public appearances, and, at any rate, I was going to Europe for a year. So the plan fell through, except as regarded Mr. Cable, who, in his way, was as fine a performer as Clemens, and could both read and sing the matter of his books. On a far less stupendous scale, they too made the rounds of the great lecturing circuit together. But I believe a famous lecture manager had charge of them, and travelled with them. He was a most sanguine man, a most amiable person, and such a believer in fortune, that Clemens used to say of him, as he said of one of his early publishers, that you could rely upon 50% of everything he promised. I myself, many years later, became a follower of this hopeful prophet, and I can testify that, at least in my case, he was able to keep 99, and even 100% of his word. It was I who was much nearer failing of mine, for I promptly began to lose sleep from the nervous stress of my lecturing, and the gratifying but killing receptions afterward, and I was truly in that state from insomnia which Clemens recognized in the brief letter I got from him in the Western City after 6 wakeful nights. He sardonically congratulated me on having gone into the lecture field, and then he said, "I know where you are now. You are in hell." It was this perdition which he re-entered when he undertook that round-the-world lecturing tour for the payment of debts left to him by the bankruptcy of his firm in the publishing business. It was not purely perdition for him, or rather, it was perdition for only one half of him, the author half. For the actor half, it was paradise. The author who takes up lecturing without the ability to give histrionic support to the literary reputation which he brings to the crude test of his reader's eyes and ears, invokes a peril and a misery unknown to the lecturer who has made his first public from the platform. Clemens was victorious on the platform from the beginning, and it would be folly to pretend that he did not exult in his triumphs there. But I suppose with the wearing nerves of middle life, he hated more and more the personal swarming of interest upon him, and all the inevitable clatter of the thing. Yet he faced it, and he labored round our tiresome globe that he might pay the uttermost farthing of debts which he had not knowingly contracted, the debts of his partners, which had meant well and done ill, not because they were evil, but because they were unwise, and as unfit for their work as he was. Pay what thou owest. That is right, even when thou owest it by the error of others, and even when thou owest it to a bank, which had not lent it from love of thee, but in the hard line of business and thy need. Clemens' behavior in this matter redounded to his glory among the nations of the whole earth, and especially in this nation, so wrapped in commerce and so little used to honor among its many thieves. He had behaved like Walter Scott, as millions rejoiced to know, who had not known how Walter Scott had behaved till they knew it was like Clemens. No doubt it will be put to his credit in the books by the recording angel, but what the judge of all the earth will say of it at the last day, there's no telling. I should not be surprised if he accounted it of less merit than some other things that Clemens did and was, less than his abhorrence of the Spanish War and the destruction of the South African republics and our deceit of the Filipinos, and his hate of slavery, and his payment of his portion of our race's debt to the race of the colored student whom he saw through college, and his support of a poor artist for 3 years in Paris, and his loan of opportunity to the youth who became the most brilliant of our actor-dramatists, and his eager pardon of the thoughtless girl who was near paying the penalty of her impertinence with the loss of her place, and his remembering that the insolent breakerman got so few dollars a month, and his sympathy for working men standing up to money in their unions, and even his pity for the wounded bird throbbing out its little life on the grass for the pleasure of the cruel fool who shot it. These and the thousand other charities and beneficences in which he abounded, openly or secretly, may avail him more than the discharge of his firm's liabilities with the judge of all the earth, who surely will do right, but whose measures and criterions no man knows, and I least of all men. He made no great show of sympathy with people in their anxieties, but it never failed, and at a time when I lay sick for many weeks, his letters were of comfort to those who feared I might not rise again. His hand was out in help for those who needed help, and in kindness for those who needed kindness. There remains in my mind the dreary sense of a long, long drive to the uttermost bounds of the South End at Boston, where he went to call upon some obscure person whose claim stretched in a lengthening chain from his early days in Missouri, a most inadequate person, in whose vacuity the gloom of the dull day deepened till it was almost too deep for tears. He bore the ordeal with grim heroism, and silently smoked away the sense of it as we drove back to Cambridge, in his slippered feet, somberly musing, somberly swearing. But he knew he had done the right, the kind thing, and he was content. He came the whole way from Hartford to go with me to a friendless play of mine, which Alessandro Salvini was giving in a series of matinees to houses never enlarging themselves beyond the count of the brave 200 who sat it through, and he stayed my fainting spirit with a cheer beyond flagons, joining me in my joke at the misery of it, and carrying the fun farther. Before that, he had come to witness the aesthetic suicide of Anna Dickinson, who had been a flaming light of the political platform in the war days, and had been left by them consuming in a hapless ambition for the theater. The poor girl had had a play written especially for her, and as Anne Boleyn she ranted and exhorted through the five acts, drawing ever nearer the utter defeat of the anti-climax. We could hardly look at each other for pity, Clemens sitting there in the box he had taken, with his shaggy head out over the corner and his slippered feet curled under him. He either went to a place in his slippers, or he carried them with him, and put them on as soon as he could put off his boots. When it was so that we could no longer follow her failure and live, he began to talk of the absolute close of her career, which the thing was, and how probably she had no conception that it was the end. He philosophized the mercifulness of the fact and of the ignorance of most of us when mortally sick or fatally wounded. We think it is not the end, because we have never ended before, and we do not see how we can end. Some can push by the awful hour and live again, but for Anna Dickinson there could be, and was, no such palingenesis. Of course, we got that solemn joy by reading her fate aright, which is the compensation of the wise spectator in witnessing the inexorable doom of others. End of chapter 14, read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox. Winter 2007. Chapter 15 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 15. When Messrs. Houghton and Mifflin became owners of the Atlantic Monthly, Mr. Houghton fancied having some breakfasts and dinners, which should bring the publisher and the editor face to face with the contributors, who were bidden from far and near. Of course, the subtle fiend of advertising, who has now grown so unblushing bold, lurked under the covers at these banquets, and the junior partner and the young editor had their joint and separate fine anguishes of misgiving as to the taste and the principle of them. But they were really very simple-hearted and honestly meant hospitalities, and they prospered as they ought, and gave great pleasure and no pain. I forget some of the emergent occasions, but I am sure of a birthday dinner most unexpectedly accepted by Whittier, and a birthday luncheon to Mrs. Stowe, and I think a birthday dinner to Longfellow, but the passing years have left me in the dark as to the pretext of that supper at which Clemens made his awful speech, and came so near being the death of us all. At the breakfasts and luncheons we had the pleasure of our lady contributors' company, but that night there were only men, and because of our strength we survived. I suppose the year was about 1879, but here the almanac is unimportant, and I can only say that it was after Clemens had become a very valued contributor of the magazine, where he found himself to his own great explicit satisfaction. He had jubilantly accepted our invitation, and had promised a speech, which it appeared afterward he had prepared with unusual care and confidence. It was his custom always to think out his speeches, mentally wording them, and then memorizing them by a peculiar system of mnemonics which he had invented. On the dinner table, a certain succession of knife, spoon, salt cellar, and butter plate symbolized a train of ideas, and on the billiard table, a ball, a cue, and a piece of chalk served the same purpose. With a diagram of these printed on the brain, he had full command of the phrases which his excogitation had attached to them, and which embodied the ideas in perfect form. He believed he had been particularly fortunate in his notion for the speech of that evening, and he had worked it out in joyous self-reliance. It was the notion of three tramps, three deadbeats, visiting a California mining camp and imposing themselves upon the innocent miners as, respectively, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and Oliver Wendell Holmes. The humor of the conception must prosper, or must fail, according to the mood of the hearer, but Clemens felt sure of compelling this to sympathy, and he looked forward to an unparalleled triumph. But there were two things that he had not taken into account. One was the species of religious veneration in which these men were held by those nearest them, a thing that I should not be able to realize to people remote from them in time and place. They were men of extraordinary dignity, of the thing called presence, for want of some clearer word, so that no one could well approach them in a personally light or trifling spirit. I do not suppose that anybody more truly valued them or more piously loved them than Clemens himself, but the intoxication of his fancy carried him beyond the bounds of that regard and emboldened him to the other thing, which he had not taken into account, namely, the immense hazard of working his fancy out before their faces, and expecting them to enter into the delight of it. If neither Emerson nor Longfellow nor Holmes had been there, the scheme might possibly have carried. But even this is doubtful, for those who so devoutly honored them would have overcome their horror with difficulty, and perhaps would not have overcome it at all. The publisher, with a modesty very ungrateful to me, had abdicated his office of host, and I was the hapless president, fulfilling the abhorred function of calling people to their feet and making them speak. When I came to Clemens, I introduced him with the cordial admiring I had for him as one of my greatest contributors and dearest friends. Here, I said, in sum, was a humorist who never left you hanging your head for having enjoyed his joke. And then, the amazing mistake, the bewildering blunder, the cruel catastrophe was upon us. I believe that, after the scope of the burlesque made itself clear, there was no one there, including the burlesquer himself, who was not smitten with a desolating dismay. There fell a silence, weighing many tons to the square inch, which deepened from moment to moment, and was broken only by the hysterical and blood-curdling laughter of a single guest, whose name shall not be handed down to infamy. Nobody knew whether to look at the speaker or down at his plate. I chose my plate as the least affliction, and so I do not know how Clemens looked, except when I stole a glance at him and saw him standing solitary amid his appalled and appalling listeners, with his joke dead on his hands. From a first glance at the great three, whom his jest had made its theme, I was aware of Longfellow sitting upright, and regarding the humorist with an air of pensive puzzle, of Holmes busily writing on his menu, with a well-feigned effect of preoccupation, and of Emerson holding his elbows and listening with a sort of Jovian oblivion of this netherworld in that lapse of memory which saved him in those later years from so much bother. Clemens must have dragged his joke to the climax and left it there, but I cannot say this from any sense of the fact of what happened afterward at the table where the immense, the wholly innocent, the truly unimagined affront was offered. I have no longer the least remembrance. I next remember being in a room of the hotel where Clemens was not to sleep, but to toss in despair, and Charles Dudley Warner's saying in the gloom, "Well, Mark, you're a funny fellow." It was as well as anything else he could have said, but Clemens seemed unable to accept the tribute. I stayed the night with him, and the next morning, after a haggard breakfast, we drove about, and he made some purchases of bric-a-brac for his house in Hartford, with a soul as far away from bric-a-brac as ever the soul of man was. He went home by an early train, and he lost no time in writing back to the three divine personalities which he had so involuntarily seemed to flout. They all wrote back to him, making it as light for him as they could. I have heard that Emerson was a good deal mystified, and in his sublime forgetfulness asked, who was this gentleman who appeared to think he had offered him some sort of annoyance? But I am not sure that this is accurate. What I am sure of is that Longfellow, a few days after, in my study, stopped before a photograph of Clemens and said, "Ah, he is a wag," and nothing more. Holmes told me, with deep emotion, such as a brother humorist might well feel, that he had not lost an instant in replying to Clemens' letter and assuring him that there had not been the least offense, and entreating him never to think of the matter again. He said that he was a fool, but he was God's fool, Holmes quoted from the letter, with a true sense of the pathos and the humor of this self-abasement. To me, Clemens wrote a week later, "It doesn't get any better. It burns like fire." But now I understand that it was not shame that burnt, but rage for a blunder which he had so incredibly committed. That, to have conceived of those men, the most dignified in our literature, our civilization, as impersonable by three hobos, and then to have imagined that he could ask them personally to enjoy the monstrous travesty, was a break, he saw too late, for which there was no repair. Yet the time came, and not so long afterward, when some mention was made of the incident as a mistake, and he said, with all his fierceness, "But I don't admit it was a mistake." And it was not so in the minds of all witnesses at second hand. The morning after the dreadful dinner, there came a glowing note from Professor Child, who had read the newspaper report of it, praising Clemens' burlesque as the richest piece of humor in the world, and betraying no sense of incongruity in its perpetration in the presence of its victims. I think it must always have ground in Clemens' soul that he was the prey of circumstances, and that if he had some more favoring occasion, he could retrieve his loss in it by giving the thing the right setting. Not more than 2 or 3 years ago, he came to try me as to trying it again at a meeting of newspaper men in Washington. I had to own my fears, while I alleged Child's note on the other hand, but in the end he did not try it with the newspaper men. I do not know whether it was ever printed or not, but since the thing happened I have often wondered how much offense there really was in it. I am not sure, but the horror of the spectators read more indignation into the subjects of the hapless drolling than they felt. But it must have been difficult for them to bear it with equanimity. To be sure, they were not themselves mocked. The joke was, of course, beside them. Nevertheless, their personality was trifled with, and I could only end by reflecting that if I had been in their place, I should not have liked it myself. Clemens would have liked it himself, for he had the heart for that sort of wild play, and he so loved a joke that even if it took the form of a liberty, and was yet a good joke, he would have loved it. But perhaps this burlesque was not a good joke. End of chapter 15, read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox, winter 2006. Chapter 16 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to learn how to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 16. Clemens was oftenest at my house in Cambridge, but he was also sometimes at my house in Belmont. When, after a year in Europe, we went to live in Boston, he was more rarely with us. We could never be long together without something out of the common happening. And one day something far out of the common happened, which, fortunately, refused the nature of absolute tragedy, while remaining rather the saddest sort of comedy. We were looking out of my library window on that view of the Charles, which I was so proud of sharing with all but my next-door neighbor, Dr. Holmes, when another friend who was with us called out with curiously impersonal interest, "Oh, see that woman getting into the water." This would have excited curiosity and alarmed anxiety far less lively than ours, and Clemens and I rushed downstairs and out through my basement and back gate. At the same time, a coachman came out of a stable next door and grappled by the shoulders a woman who was somewhat deliberately getting down the steps to the water over the face of the embankment. Before we could reach them, he had pulled her up to the driveway and stood holding her there while she crazily grieved at her rescue. As soon as he saw us, he went back into his stable and left us with the poor wild creature on our hands. She was not very young and not very pretty, and we could not have flattered ourselves with the notion of anything romantic in her suicidal mania, but we could take her on the broad human level. And on this we proposed to escort her up Beacon Street till we could give her into the keeping of one of those kindly policemen whom our neighborhood knew. Naturally, there were no policemen known to us or unknown the whole way to the public garden. We had to circumvent our charge in her present design of drowning herself and walk her past the streets crossing Beacon to the river. At these points it needed considerable reasoning to overcome her wish and some active maneuvering in both of us to enforce our arguments. Nobody else appeared to be interested, and though we did not court publicity in the performance of the duty so strangely laid upon us, still it was rather disappointing to be so entirely ignored. There are some 4 or 5 crossings to the river between 302 Beacon Street and the public garden, and the suggestions at our command were pretty well exhausted by the time we reached it. Still, the expected policeman was nowhere in sight. But a brilliant thought occurred to Clemens. He asked me where the nearest police station was, and when I told him, he started off at his highest speed, leaving me in sole charge of our hapless ward. all my powers of suasion were now taxed to the utmost, and I began attracting attention as a short, stout gentleman in early middle life endeavoring to distrain a respectable female of her personal liberty, when his accomplice had abandoned him to his wicked design. After a much longer time than I thought I should have taken to get a policeman from the station, Clemens reappeared in easy conversation with an officer who had probably realized that he was in the company of Mark Twain, and was in no hurry to end the interview. He took possession of our captive, and we saw her no more. I now wonder that with our joint instinct for failure we ever got rid of her, but I am sure we did, and few things in life have given me greater relief. When we got back to my house, we found the friend we had left there quite unruffled and not much concerned to know the facts of our adventure. My impression is that he had been taking a nap on my lounge. He appeared refreshed and even gay. But if I am inexact in these details, he is alive to refute me. End of chapter 16. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox, winter 2006. Chapter 17 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 17. A little after this, Clemens went abroad with his family and lived several years in Germany. His letters still came, but at longer intervals, and the thread of our intimate relations was inevitably broken. He would write me when something I had written pleased him, or when something signal occurred to him, or some political or social outrage stirred him to wrath, and he wished to free his mind in pious profanity. During this sojourn he came near dying of pneumonia in Berlin, and he had slight relapses from it after coming home. In Berlin, also, he had the honor of dining with the German emperor at the table of a cousin married to a high officer of the court. Clemens was a man to enjoy such a distinction. He knew how to take it as a delegated recognition from the German people. But as coming from a rather cock-a-hoop sovereign, who had as yet only his sovereignty to value himself upon, he was not very proud of it. He expressed a quiet disdain of the event as between the imperiality and himself, on whom it was supposed to confer such glory, crowning his life with the topmost leaf of laurel. He was in the same mood, in his account, of an English dinner party many years before, where there was a little Scotch lord present, to whom the English tacitly referred Clemens' talk, and laughed when the lord laughed, and were grave when he failed to smile. Of all the men I have known, he was the farthest from a snob, though he valued recognition, and liked the flattery of the fashionable fair when it came in his way. He would not go out of his way for it, but, like most able and brilliant men, he loved the minds of women, their wit, their agile cleverness, their sensitive perception, their humorous appreciation, the saucy things they would say, and their pretty, temerarious defiances. He had, of course, the keenest sense of what was truly dignified and truly undignified in people, but he was not really interested in what we call society affairs. They scarcely existed for him, though his books witness how he abhorred the dreadful fools who through some chance of birth or wealth hold themselves different from other men. Commonly, he did not keep things to himself, especially dislikes and condemnations. Upon most current events he had strong opinions, and he uttered them strongly. After a while he was silent in them, but if you tried him, you found him in them still. He was tremendously worked up by a certain famous trial, as most of us were who lived in the time of it. He believed the accused guilty, but when we met some months after it was over, and I tempted him to speak his mind upon it, he would only say, "The man had suffered enough," as if the man had expiated his wrong, and he was not going to do anything to renew his penalty. I found that very curious, very delicate. His continued blame could not come to the sufferer's knowledge, but he felt it his duty to forbear it. He was apt to wear himself out in the vehemence of his resentments, or he had so spent himself in uttering them that he had literally nothing more to say. You could offer Clemens offenses that would anger other men, and he did not mind. He would account for them from human nature. But if he thought you had in any way played him false, you were anathema and maranatha forever. Yet not forever. Perhaps, for by and by, after years, he would be silent. There were two men, half a generation apart in their succession, whom he thought equally atrocious in their treason to him, and of whom he used to talk terrifyingly, even after they were out of the world. He went farther than Heine, who said that he forgave his enemies, but not till they were dead. Clemens did not forgive his dead enemies. Their deaths seemed to deepen their crimes, like a base evasion or a cowardly attempt to escape. He pursued them to the grave. He would like to dig them up and take vengeance upon their clay. So he said, but no doubt he would not have hurt them if he had them living before him. He was generous without stint. He trusted without measure. But where his generosity was abused or his trust betrayed, he was a fire of vengeance, a consuming flame of suspicion that no sprinkling of cool patience from others could quench. It had to burn itself out. He was eagerly and lavishly hospitable, but if a man seemed willing to batten on him, or in any way to lie down upon him, Clemens despised him unutterably. In his frenzies of resentment or suspicion, he would not, and doubtless could not, listen to reason. But if between the paroxysms he were confronted with the facts, he would own them, no matter how much they told against him. At one period he fancied that a certain newspaper was hounding him with biting censure and poisonous paragraphs, and he was filling himself up with wrath to be duly discharged on the editor's head. Later, he wrote me with a humorous joy in his mistake that Warner had advised him to have the paper watched for these injuries. He had done so, and how many mentions of him did I reckon he had found in 3 months? Just two, and they were rather indifferent than unfriendly. So the paper was acquitted, and the editor's life was spared. The wretch never knew how near he was to losing it, with incredible preliminaries of obloquy and a subsequent devotion to lasting infamy. His memory for favors was as good as for injuries, and he liked to return your friendliness with as loud a band of music as could be bought or bribed for the occasion. All that you had to do was to signify that you wanted his help. When my father was consul at Toronto during Arthur's administration, he fancied that his place was in danger, and he appealed to me. In turn, I appealed to Clemens, bethinking myself of his friendship with Grant and Grant's friendship with Arthur. I asked him to write to Grant in my father's behalf. "But no," he answered me, "I must come to Hartford, and we would go on to New York together and see Grant personally. This was before, and long before, Clemens became Grant's publisher and splendid benefactor. But the men liked each other, as such men could not help doing. Clemens made the appointment, and we went to find Grant in his business office, that place where his business innocence was afterwards so betrayed. He was very simple and very cordial, and I was instantly the more at home with him, because his voice was the soft, rounded Ohio River accent to which my ears were earliest used, from my steamboating uncles, my earliest heroes. When I stated my business, he merely said, "Oh, no, that must not be. He would write to Mr. Arthur," and he did so that day. And my father lived to lay down his office, when he tired of it, with no urgence from above. It is not irrelevant to Clemens to say that Grant seemed to like finding himself in company with two literary men, one of whom, at least, he could make sure of, and, unlike that silent man he was reputed, he talked constantly, and, so far as he might, he talked literature. At least, he talked of John Phoenix, that delightfulest of the early Pacific Slope humorists, whom he had known under his real name of George H. Derby, when they were fellow cadets at West Point. It was mighty pretty, as Pepys would say, to see the delicate deference Clemens paid our plain hero, and the manly respect with which he listened. While Grant talked, his luncheon was brought in from some unassuming restaurant nearby, and he asked us to join him in the baked beans and coffee which were served us in a little room out of the office with about the same circumstance as at a railroad refreshment counter. The baked beans and coffee were of about the railroad refreshment quality, but eating them with Grant was like sitting down to baked beans and coffee with Julius Caesar or Alexander or some other great Plutarchan captain. One of the highest satisfactions of Clemens' often supremely satisfactory life was his relation to Grant. It was his proud joy to tell how he found Grant about to sign a contract for his book on, certainly, very good terms, and said to him that he would himself publish the book and give him a percentage 3 times as large. He said Grant seemed to doubt whether he could honorably withdraw from the negotiation at that point, but Clemens overbore his scruples, and it was his unparalleled privilege, his princely pleasure, to pay the author a far larger check for his work than had ever been paid to an author before. He valued even more than this splendid opportunity the sacred moments in which their business brought him into the presence of the slowly dying, heroically living man whom he was so befriending. And he told me in words which surely lost none of their simple pathos, through his report, how Grant described his suffering. The prosperity of this venture was the beginning of Clemens' adversity, for it led to excesses of enterprise which were forms of dissipation. The young sculptor who had come back to him from Paris modeled a small bust of Grant, which Clemens multiplied in great numbers, to his great loss, and the success of Grant's book tempted him to launch on publishing seas where his bark presently foundered. The first and greatest of his disasters was the life of Pope Leo XIII, which he came to tell me of when he had imagined it in a sort of delirious exultation. He had no words in which to paint the magnificence of the project or to forecast its colossal success. It would have a currency bounded only by the number of Catholics in Christendom. It would be translated into every language which was anywhere written or printed. It would be circulated literally in every country of the globe, and Clemens' book agents would carry the prospectuses and then the bound copies of the work to the ends of the whole earth. Not only would every Catholic buy it, but every Catholic must, as he was a good Catholic, as he hoped to be saved. It was a magnificent scheme, and it captivated me. as it had captivated Clemens, it dazzled us both, and neither of us saw the fatal defect in it. We did not consider how often Catholics could not read, how often, when they could, they might not wish to read. The event proved that, whether they could read or not, the immeasurable majority did not wish to read the life of the Pope, though it was written by a dignitary of the Church and issued to the world with every sanction from the Vatican. The failure was incredible to Clemens. His sanguine soul was utterly confounded, and soon a silence fell upon it where it had been so exuberantly jubilant. End of chapter 17. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Winter 2006.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.